We can't wait for you to hear this episode all about the electrifying history of Scotland's first cookery schools. But please note, I do have some issues with my mic in the first half of this episode, so please bear with.
Hello, I'm Peter Gilchrist.
And I'm Dr. Lindsay Middleton.
We are on a mission to investigate Scotland's food history, from the folklore of its ancient people to the traditions of our own grandparents.
We'll be talking to historians, producers, and Scotland's finest to try and uncover the chapters from our nation's food story.
And this season, we're taking a look at the people that revolutionised Scotland's cuisine.
We'll be diving back into the 19th century and talking to today's food champions.
It's time to investigate our great Scots. When we were looking at today's episode, which is all about schools of domestic science and food education in Scotland, which sounds a bit dry, but please trust me, this is anything but dry. There is only one woman that we could think of to join us for the podcast. And instead of being a guest at the end, we wanted to have her sprinkled throughout the episode. So please welcome to the podcast, Dr. Eleanor Peters.
Thank you very much for having me on. I'm very flattered to be asked. Delighted to be here.
No, you're far. I should resign now. You and Lindsay should continue on the Scottish Food History. Well, yeah, I think you'd be grand together.
For a bit of context, Ellen and I go way back because we had the same PhD supervisor, and we're doing our PhDs at the same time. So shout out to the lovely Dr. Ben Marsden at the University of Aberdeen, who had to put up with both of us at the same time doing weird things with food and technology and genuinely just being probably quite hard work in the best way, I'm sure he would say.
I am sometimes
being a bit resistant maybe to advice and feedback.
There was definitely times where we would each get feedback and I would need to message Eleanor like, I've just had feedback from Ben and I'm freaking out, but it was good. We had each other as a lifeline throughout it. So sisters in food history in a way. For this episode, as Peter said, we're going to be talking around sort of different women in the past, different cookery schools, different cookbooks. And really the theme is how, as we've seen in other episodes of our series, how women used food to sort of really revolutionise things in their own context.
I want to note, I have 60 seconds on a man for this episode.
Banned.
A man, but you will agree with me that it is a well-deserved 60 seconds, if not minute and a half, to give over to the man himself. So, but maybe I think we want to start with yourself, Dr. Peters, as you make us call you. We tried to call you Eleanor before the episode. You said no, Dr. Peters, or nothing. How did you get into history? What was your journey into history? And then what was your journey into food history? Or was that the evolution for you?
How far back are we going here?
Start day one. Open my eyes.
I am born.
Yeah.
I come into this world. I loved museum trips as a child. I usually made a beeline to the Egyptian room at the National Museum of Scotland. I have not grown up to be an Egyptologist, sadly, but instead I maintained my interest in history throughout high school, moving on to do my history degree at University of Aberdeen, shout out to University of Aberdeen, and subsequently did my PhD there. And when asked, why are you doing a PhD in history? Usually the answer I could muster up was, I just love history. I just love the research. I like the process of being in the archives and that little light bulb moment when you find something and it fits into place with a theory or an idea that you had. And these are all the reasons why I've ended up being Dr. Eleanor Peters.
And I'll jump in and say Ben would always tell me how good Eleanor was. Like, even before I'd started my PhD, he's like, I've got this other student and she, like, won an award for her master's, or maybe it was your undergrad, and he was just, and I was like, great, way to, like, stake the competitive edge.
I think he was doing this to pit each, but to pit us against each other, though.
Yeah.
Because he would say, Lindsay's very, you know, she takes the initiative in things and she comes up with all of these really interesting off-the-wall ideas about things to do. And he was always like, Eleanor, you're very focused on writing the thesis, but Lindsay's interested in what's beyond the thesis, you know. And I think he was worried I wasn't taking enough interest outside of what I was writing about.
If Ryan Murphy needs a season 3 for Feud, we know where to go. Aberdeen University.
I mean, it kind of worked because we both ended up with very good PhDs and being friends. So at least we're not sworn rivals.
No. It was a dangerous game.
Yeah.
On the last episode, we were interviewing Sam Bilton about how she got into food history and food research. Mm-hmm. And one of the questions I asked her was, do you remember what the first kind of eureka moment was where you found a bit of information where you thought, I don't know if everyone knows this, or I've just discovered something? Do you remember, was there a moment for you where there was something that kind of realigned how you thought about food history, or your first moment that gave you that butterfly of, I think I'm discovering something?
I guess I'm a bit of an intruder or an interloper, because I wouldn't necessarily describe myself as a food historian. However, I would definitely say that because I have this passion about food technology, and more widely electrical appliances, that's how I've ended up maybe intercepting your realm on this podcast.
We welcome history. There's like 7 of us that are in here. You're welcome to the party. But do you remember, or what was there, or just even a general history, what was your first eureka moment?
That's a really good question.
We will edit out you thinking about it.
About me? think of a really good story, think of something good. Well, when I was doing my research for my PhD, I had several trips to Queen Margaret University. As you all know, its predecessor was Edinburgh School of Cookery and Domestic Economy. And luckily, I was doing my research in a room that housed sort of old electrical appliances and irons and beautiful silverware and utensils. And I think there was something about the fact that I had tangible history around me, as well as these, unfortunately, quite dry minute books that I needed to somehow plough my way through, was quite inspirational. The fact that I could be reading about, you know, cookery classes and look to the left of me and see, you know, knives and forks and, you know, beautiful crockery and these amazing kind of silverware dishes, you know, it really, it brought it to life for me while I was doing that sort of initial kind of grunt work. Yeah.
I always feel it's a bit like when you get into collecting kitchen antiques and reading about it. It's like what lots of people experience when they watch like a really great historic drama series, that are like, you know, like The Crown or something which has been invested in sets, and you can tell the fashion's on point and everything that they're touching and the props, it's so real, and you're allowed to enter that world. When you're researching and you can surround yourself and you can touch the implements of the time, it's that feeling of being lost in it for a moment and being able to really use all your senses to enter into another world.
It was immersive. Yeah.
Yeah. I think food's so good for that, not only because you can kind of imagine what people were eating, you can sort of associate the tastes with things you know, but it's also when you're in the past, there's that difference that makes it intriguing and exciting. And then when you're looking at these texts, these cookery texts, it's those little extra bits, the scribbles on recipes or the like flecks of fat on a page that let you know that someone 100 years ago really liked this recipe, like that as a kind of tangible, tastable history is, it definitely is what hooked me into it.
You're such a wordsmith, Lindsay. The flecks of fat on the antique cookery page that lets you know somebody 100 years ago really liked that recipe. Jeez Louise. I think we should take a break.
Okay. So we're going to be sort of centering this episode around different points of time, different cities, texts, but also cookery schools. And I'm going to kind of describe something that's very close to my heart because I've worked on, so I worked on a sort of big project on this while I was doing my PhD. And that is the Glasgow Cookery Book and the institutions that sort of formed the Glasgow Cookery Book. So I have with me, I have two copies. I have this really shiny, lovely one, which was very kindly gifted to me by the Glasgow Caledonian University, because when I was doing my project, it was in the archives and special collections of GCU, which I didn't realise until I'd done this project, have an incredible food archive. Because basically GCU was one of the founding institutions of it, was a cookery school. And then I have my other slightly older, it's not as old as I would like it to be. This is from the 70s, but I really like this little like apple, and we have the scales. But what you can see between the two of them is the kind of iconic purple cover. And the Glasgow Cookery Book is one of these things that if you ask people about it in Glasgow, particularly women, most people say, oh, I've got a copy of that, or my mum had a copy of that. So I became interested in this when I was doing a brief project around invalid recipes and how women in Scotland were sort of participating in the health space, both as people who went and worked in hospitals, but also within the home, how food and recipes were used to treat the sick. So the archivist who was there at the time and has retired since, Carol McCallum. Carol, that's hard to say.
I didn't know she'd retired.
Is this a new purple burglar alarm for Scottish people?
Do any else?
Carol McCallum, what is that? Carol purple burglar alarm.
Purple, yeah. Purple cookery book with Carol. Anyway. The archivist who was at GCU at the time, who's retired since, Carol McCallum, had this like wealth of knowledge about the institution's history and the woman who'd made it up. So I went into the archive not really knowing what I was going to find, and stumbling upon hundreds of years of food education in Glasgow that I didn't really know existed. So this was amazing to me, and it all really starts. There's several kind of women that you know, that were really important to this. But one of the sort of earliest still in the 19th century was Margaret Black. And Margaret Black was born in 1830. She lived until 1903. So very much in that sort of Victorian period we've been looking at. And she had a really interesting life. She was a widow, which meant she could be quite entrepreneurial. She wasn't tied to having a husband. And initially, she was a leading cookery teacher at the Glasgow School of Cookery. So this was the first sort of formal school of cookery set up in Glasgow in the 19th century. And she had come to the school as a widow. And what the Glasgow School of Cookery wanted to do at that point was introduce a more kind of scientific focus to what they were teaching. So they sent her down to Kensington, and she went to the National Training School of Cookery, and she was sort of taught how to do cookery teaching, but also like very much it had a kind of scientific background. So she came to Glasgow, and she wrote her own cookery book. She had several like household cookery and laundry work, and then she had superior cookery, which was like slightly fancier recipes. And she was very clearly very entrepreneurial. But what was interesting was in the 1870s, she left the Glasgow School of Cookery because apparently there was some like drama between her and the principal at the time, who was called Grace Patterson. And Margaret Black left in 1878, and she set up the West End School of Cookery. Now, as someone who works at Glasgow Uni, it was really interesting to me because the West End School of Cookery, the initial building, is kind of tied to Glasgow Uni, and they still own it and I think use it for teaching. So this was the 1870s. We had these multiple cookery schools in Glasgow, and so what eventually ended up happening was the two cookery schools, the Glasgow Cookery School and the West End School of Cookery, came back together to have the clunkiest named institution I've ever come across. Even if you're like trying to, you know, make it an acronym, it was the Glasgow and West of Scotland College of Domestic Science.
Yeah.
Glasgow and West of Scotland College of Domestic Science. That's 9 words. So this was set up in 1903. It was 1908, sorry. So it was 5 years after Margaret Black died, but it was actually her niece who went on to work at the school. So we have this sort of lineage of these women who are running educational institutions. But the Glasgow and West of Scotland College of Domestic Science became known as the Doe School. So colloquially in Glasgow, it was meant to be DO because it shortened domestic to DO, but actually people called it like DOUH, as in like it's the Doe School. Oh. They're doing things with dough.
Was that intentional, or did that was just somebody was like, I'm going to learn to cook at the Doe School, and they were like, oh right, I hear you.
You're D-O-U-G-H. Making bread, right? So I think it wasn't intentional to begin with, but in all the newspaper articles, it's D-O-U-H, and it became like a sort of unofficial name. So the Doe School was run by a woman called Ella Glaister, and she was the one who sort of commissioned the first of the Glasgow cookery books. So 2 years after the school opened, the first edition was published in 1910, and initially it was meant to be just for students of the Doe School. So it was a kind of learning resource that accompanied the classes, and you could do different kinds of classes. You could do sort of housewifery, you could do different types of cookery. Later you could do dietetics and nutrition.
I'm glad you did bring up the dietetics, Lindsay, just because there is this very interesting relationship between introducing dietetics at the Glasgow and West of Scotland College of Domestic Science and bringing in electrical appliances, because both were seen to kind of enhance the prestige of the college, right. That domestic science is taking that leap forward into being that bit more scientific. There's this brilliant teacher who joins the Glasgow College, Mary Andros, who has a science degree from Glasgow University, I believe. Yeah,
and then she was doing like defence chemistry or something.
Yeah, she's spectacular. And they give her budget to spend they give her a generous budget to basically have the choice of what kind of fittings and equipment she wants in the dietetic kitchen. And she chooses, you know, like the all electric dietetic kitchen, basically. So there is that really interesting relationship between the dietetics and the school bringing more electrical equipment in. Yeah.
But in those first editions, it's interesting, and Peter, you earlier showed us your version, which seems quite old and has those sort of notes sections in the back.
I mean, I don't know when my version is from. This is one of the first cookery books that I bought, and it's definitely like it's almost medieval in its lettering and typography,
but still the same. It's been the same purple the whole time, which is just crazy.
And this is the Glasgow and West of Scotland College of Domestic Science, in brackets, unincorporated.
Okay.
So I don't know if they went through a phase of forming and dealing with governance, but at this point they are unincorporated.
It's in the minute books if you want to read it.
Is it? Right. Sorry, I just shouted into the mic there. I'm so alive with meeting minutes here. Have you read the meeting minutes of the Glasgow West of College Domestic whatever Doe School?
I did have to plough through those minute books in order to get my insights. Yes, I did. And took us right through the incorporation of the Glasgow and West of Scotland College of Domestic Science.
Right, so I need to work out when this is from. I need to Google when it was, or I don't think you would know off the top of your head what year it was incorporated.
I know, we're really putting you on the spot here.
I know. Tell us the meeting minutes that you read 7 years ago. In there was a date of incorporation. Tell us now.
I think that's amazing that you've looked through all those books, because they are many and, as you said, Eleanor, pretty dry.
Voluminous.
But yes, we end up with this cookbook that at some point it stops being just a tool for the students, and actually it becomes published. So you have a point in fact, I do have this written down somewhere, but I don't know where. Okay, yeah. So you have a point in the 1950s where it changes, and it's we get what's called the New Revised Edition. And this was 1951. And what happened basically was the publisher of the cookbook had changed. It had been N. Adshead and Son, and it became John Smith. So John Smith, as a Glaswegian publisher, is like a major powerhouse in Scottish publishing. To this day, you know, we have a John Smith bookshop on the University of Glasgow's campus. But what John Smith did was they kind of made it a commercial project, a product. So it was going out all over Glasgow in Scotland. And that was the point where you have like people buying it as wedding gifts. People, it kind of becomes Glasgow's like Mrs. Beaton's, you know, it's like the Book of Household Management, but the Scottish version for Glasgow.
Mine was printed by Adshead.
Nice. So you must have, you're pre-1950 then, we can say for sure.
Well, I mean, yeah.
Yeah.
by the recipe for turtle soup, I think we can say it was probably.
I think you're probably right. So we have this amazing cookbook, and one of the things I did during this project was I looked through all the editions that they had in the archive at GCU. So they have a couple of editions of the first edition, and then they have right up to the centenary edition, which is the one I have here, which was published in 2009. And I'd just been looking at the chapter on invalid recipes really for this project, but what was amazing is how little it changed. There were some like formatting changes. There were some like obviously updates, some ingredients you're getting in the 1970s that you don't get in the 1910s, of course, but largely it stays fairly true to its roots. So it's a really interesting artifact. And one of the things I loved about it was it retains for the longest time those notes pages, and you get those snippets of, I found this amazing one where this woman had clearly been an amazing baker, and she was making wedding cakes for all these people. So it was like, Mrs. Jones's wedding cake, here's the recipe. Mrs. Such and Such's wedding cake, here's the recipe. Mrs. And I found one, and it had soy in it, like soy flour. And I was like, why does this have soy? And it still had eggs, so it wasn't a kind of vegan thing. And I remember putting something out on Twitter, and my friend Kevin Geddes, another food historian friend of ours, he had said, oh, it must have been a war thing. So instead of like having wheat flour at the time, they were using soya. And it just seemed, from all these little handwritten recipes, you can just trace the history of all these different women and how they lived and cooked. So, I mean, we've spoken more about
it. Hard to still have your dream wedding cake as well.
I know.
In times of austerity or restricted trade.
Exactly. To be inventive enough to like be, okay, this is how we substitute. Yeah.
We're still having a cake.
We're still
having a cake. The cake is happening.
I know. It shows how those schools from the kind of late 19th century right through to when Glasgow Caledonian University was formed, like that was a space in which women were very much innovating. You know, they were teaching science, they were teaching nutrition. Glasgow Caledonian was one of the first places to teach dietetics, and it's still like a forerunner of that. And actually, when it was the Doe School, they were the first people to offer dietetics outside of London. So we were kind of, it wasn't just cookery as you know, domestic education. It was cookery for health. It was cookery for science and innovation, which I love.
Mm-hmm. I first heard about the Glasgow Cookery Book. I'd phoned my grand's sister, who's still alive up in Kyle, up in the Highlands, and I was asking her about what did you learn to cook on? What were the cookery books that you had in your home? And she said, in her wonderful Highland accent, "You should go and look at the Glasgow Cookery Book." That is a dead-on impression, by the way. And I went online and searched it, and there are PDF. If anyone is interested, you can find online versions of the Glasgow Cookery Book. But it was in there where I saw an ingredient called paisley flour. And when we're talking about what was your eureka moment, for me, it was finding out about Brown and Poulsen and the invention of corn flour and all of the other kind of ingredients that they created, and the tins that has my hometown plastered across it that I had never heard of. And that for me was the beginning of my understanding of food can reshape your entire understanding of your place and yourself and your family and your community. And now every time I have my Gran's recipe has corn flour in it. And the only reason it has that is because she was a Paisley granny who was sold these recipes and who probably had a copy of the Glasgow cookery book in her collection.
With a Wholesome Brown advert in the front pages, I'm sure.
Exactly. Exactly.
Today I'm going to be talking about two women, the two women that would go on to found the Edinburgh School of Cookery. The first one, her name is Louisa Stevenson, and she was born in 1835. Now, she was born into a relatively wealthy family. I've counted six siblings in total, but they were all pretty prolific. One of her sisters, Flora, was the founder of the Edinburgh National Society for Women's Suffrage. One of her brothers was an MP. There was a lot of money. Her dad was a merchant. She was born in Glasgow, but they moved down to England, to Wales, and then back up to Edinburgh at 19. And soon after, she was a founding member of the Edinburgh National Society for Women's Suffrage.
Another mouthful.
Another mouthful. This is the thing about Victorian societies. And we did this when we were trying to talk about Florence Marion McNeill, and we were talking about, it was like the Scotland and West Society for the Preservation of Women's Suffrage Societies and the Federation. It was like absolute nonsense. A worthwhile job, but they did. If I was back then, we would have had a snappier title.
They need PR, man. Like,
yeah, they do. A PR woman, Lindsay.
Yes, a PR woman.
Louisa begins to get involved in the Edinburgh Ladies Educational Association, and that's really where things start. And this was a society in Edinburgh that was really campaigning to allow women into formal higher education. There was women at that time were beginning to allow to get kind of medical approval and were able to begin to study medicine, but they weren't able to get a degree. They certainly were not considered equal to men. There was lots of conversations about how will the women deal with university? Where will they live? How will they be able to hold themselves together for an examination? Deeply, deeply misogynistic things. But actually, Louisa's work really took her around the country, both in England, Wales, Scotland, and she was talking at conferences. There was a really interesting conference in 1868, the Conference on Women's Work, which was in Glasgow. It was a four-day conference. Here are some of the titles of talks that were presented. The Work of Women in Settlements, The Care of the Aged and Poor, The Conditions of Domestic Service, The Student Life of Women, The Causes of Intemperance Among Women, and how women can raise the moral standard.
No pressure.
A lot, but I mean, I was reading that and like, women are going to raise the moral standard. Okay, I'm sure.
We do.
Classic Victorian chat, though.
Like. You absolutely do. It's all about women. It's your responsibility to raise the moral standard.
Absolutely.
But yeah, actually, the Edinburgh Ladies Educational Association is where she meets another woman, Christian Guthrie Wright. Now, Christian Guthrie Wright, she was another woman that was born in Glasgow. Again, quite a bit of money that she is born into, and she spends most of her life in Edinburgh. She was a founding member of the Ladies Edinburgh Debating Society, and she became the honorary treasurer for the Edinburgh Association for the University Education of Women. Now, together, they would go on, Louisa and Christian, they would go on to found the Edinburgh School of Cookery. Christian and Louisa are working together to try and open up university doors for women. And one of the first things that they did together was in 1868, where they created a series of lectures that were delivered by David Mason, who was a Scottish academic. He was a professor of rhetoric and English literature at Edinburgh University. Now, I'm going to talk about this man.
Is this your 60 man seconds? Right. I'm going to start my timer.
Yeah, start your timer. 60 seconds for this man. David Mason had married a woman called Emily Rosalind Orme. Now, we don't know whether he arrived at feminism by himself, and that's why he married a suffragist, why he married such a prolific feminist, or whether in his marriage to Emily he found feminism, but we know that she had a
radicalized.
Big... Oh yeah, definitely. We know that she had a big impact on him, and he became a real supporter for the movement to get women into university. Now, David was introduced to his wife by his wife's uncle. His wife's uncle was Coventry Patmore.
No way.
Coventry Patmore was the poet who wrote the Angel in the House.
Oh my God. Well, that couldn't have gone any worse.
No, but this was one of those moments, again, talking about Eureka moments, where if you've listened to this podcast before, me and Lindsay mentioned the Angel in the House at least once an episode, because what he created through his stunning misogyny was an expectation for women to be an angel in the home, to be perfect, to cook great food, to be wise and to be temperate, to be... loving and skilled, and to be inhuman in so many ways.
It's also just a really stinking poem.
And I wonder if, obviously, he was married in, so it was his wife's niece, who obviously was this prolific. I wonder if she became a prolific feminist in rebellion.
Because she was having to listen to this over dinner parties. Can you imagine?
I think this is a wonderful Netflix series about feminism in Edinburgh in the Victorian era, because it's so, like, the dichotomy between your uncle being Coventry Patmore and your husband being David Mason, this man who takes on the charge of getting women into university. He delivers these first lectures for women, and they're lectures on history, on English, and it's quite a bold thing that he is doing as the professor of rhetoric and English literature to begin to provide these lectures exclusively for women.
I'm just imagining, like, having several family Christmases with this Coventry Patmore and being like, we need to stop this. This is awful.
Listen, when I saw Coventry Patmore, I was like, where have I heard that before? And then clicked on his, I was like, Lindsay is going to love this. The symmetry of story here is wonderful. Anyway, we've given the men too much time. Back to the women. So in 1875, in November of 1875, I think the Glasgow Cookery School was also 1875. I think they were a wee bit earlier, perhaps in summer. But in that November, the Edinburgh School of Cookery launched its first classes. And I've got a wee excerpt from the newspaper here. The Edinburgh School of Cookery, the public opening will take place in temporary classrooms in the Museum of Science and Art on Tuesday, the 9th of November at 2 o'clock. The Lord Provost in the chair. It talks about some of the professors that are going to be making talks, and admission is free. Classes commence on Wednesday the 10th. Tickets and prospectuses are available. But yes, it's a really exciting moment where these two women have campaigned for the majority of their adult life. I mean, Louisa, she comes to Edinburgh when she's 19 and immediately takes up the charge of not only supporting women's education, supporting poor women, lobbying for equal rights, getting involved in suffrage, and in 1875 they finally get the doors open, at first in a temporary accommodation, but it's university open, it's learning open for women.
You're right, Peter, it's a massive moment. So the Glasgow School of Cookery was 1876, so it's
Our podcast is all out of whack now. All out of whack. For God's sake, I need a stiff drink. It's all out of whack. And then the first Edinburgh School of Cookery book, which was titled The School Cookery Book, was published in 1879. And it was authored by Miss Guthrie. Miss Guthrie Wright herself, the founder. Now, I don't have a copy of The School Cookery Book, but I do have the plain cookery recipes. There is also advanced cookery recipes, and at this point it is the Edinburgh School of Cookery and Domestic Economy, which I think was 1930. It was Edinburgh College of Domestic Science, so it's sometime between there, isn't it?
1930 it becomes Edinburgh College of Domestic Science.
So do you know, obviously, so this must be pre-1930 then, as the Edinburgh School of Cookery. What I love about this book is the student has obviously written their name in, which was Phyllis.
Aww.
Oh, Phyllis.
There's always a Phyllis.
Yeah.
One of my other books that I've got, maybe I won't include this. I have another copy of the Glasgow Cookery Book, and the person wrote their name and their age, and I was able to Google them and find out they had passed away a couple of years ago.
Oh no.
And like, they're got in touch with their daughter. I'm not on her Facebook, and unfortunately she passed away last year. And then messaged her grandson, who hasn't seen the message yet, to say, by the way, I have your grand's Glasgow Cookery Book. It's got all of her recipes and corrections and notes made on it.
Aww.
Anyway.
It's very nice of you to do that, though.
Hmm. I feel like cookery books are, like, for so many of us, are one of the only family heirlooms that we might ever inherit, you know?
Yeah.
It's things which live in our lives and are things that we hold on to because they hold the keys to the kitchen and our favourite recipes and our things that we turn to when we want to celebrate some of life's greatest moments. When it's birthdays, celebrations, the wedding cakes, it's the things that fill a life and provide the frame for our greatest moments. And I think that for lots of us, sometimes we can be quite practical when we're having a clear out and we think, oh, I don't use that anymore, or that's all those old bits of notes and things. But when people pass, when people leave us, sometimes being able to have a little scribble about the time that they failed in that kitchen, or when that recipe didn't work, or Aunt Jeannie's shortbread, it allows us to, in a moment, feel quite connected. This got too poetic. I apologise profusely. So back to the story. Christian Guthrie Wright, she passes away in 1907 at the age of 63, quite young actually. And in 1908, the year after, Louisa passed away. She was 72, but again, she represented the year before, she represented the Edinburgh suffragists at the 1906 meeting with the Prime Minister, and she's remembered as being a poor law guardian for the city to ensure poor women are getting access to much needed resources and the city's poor houses. In 1930, as we said, the school became the Edinburgh College of Domestic Science. In 1972, it became Queen Margaret College, and in 2007, it became Queen Margaret University.
I think it's so interesting how there's this like similar trajectory between, like, I mean, obviously Glasgow Caledonian University was formed by two institutions, one of which had been the college and one was the old polytechnic, so it was kind of a merging of two. But I love the fact that these two now very prolific Scottish universities were formed on cookery schools that women had to basically, like, as you said, Peter, like, campaign to open, because there was a massive gap in women being educated. So yeah, it's really interesting to see the parallels. And I haven't, sorry, Eleanor.
Sorry, Lindsay. No, sorry.
No, I was just going to say, I haven't managed to look it up, but I would be very surprised if, you know, Guthrie didn't also know Margaret Black, because they were living at the same time, they were doing the same things.
Yes. Yeah. I believe they did have correspondence with each other. And I was going to say about Grace Patterson, because you mentioned Grace Patterson, Lindsay.
Yes.
Because she was also an ardent supporter of female suffrage and a philanthropist. And she was she was elected to the Glasgow School Board in 1885. And school boards were, you know, enormously significant, important opportunities for women at a time when they didn't have the vote, obviously. So having that sway and being able to push through that agenda of opening a cookery school in Glasgow, it was integral that she was on the school board, basically, to get that started.
Amazing. I wonder what the difference is between Black and Patterson that led to Margaret leaving and opening her own school. Again, there's so much intrigue here. You're right, Peter. We need like a late 19th, early 20th Central Belt Cookery School Netflix documentary.
I feel it, because also, if you go online,
we can call it that.
And to honour the institutions that had the longest, most protracted names, we will find the worst possible name for a limited series on Netflix. I was going to make a point and I've completely forgotten it. No, if you want to have a wee look on the Queen Margaret University, has some fantastic pictures of the cookery school, where you see these kind of very Edwardian women wearing bustles and very starched aprons standing in a circle around, I'm assuming, a kind of hot plate and kind of preparation stations. And it is a rife, rich world for to be explored. In 1897, the first hall of residence for women was opened at the University of Edinburgh, and its name was Mason Hall, named after David Mason, who gave the first lectures for women.
Aww.
And I think, again, it's that very, like, that world, when you look at some of the pictures of the Mason Hall and the women who are living in there, it looks, number one, like an absolute hoot. Mm-hmm. That I would have loved to have known some of these characters. But again, for these women, it was like, for some of them, when they were born, it didn't seem not seem possible that they would get to go to university, that they could leave home and live with other women. Culturally, such a time of upheaval that, again, I think should be better explored for our entertainment.
I think what was really important about domestic science colleges was the fact that domestic science was blurring this boundary between public and private, because women were taking on this role in public education, performing cookery demonstrations, travelling across the country to do these demonstrations, but their work pertained to domestic matters only. So they could still maintain a stance of one foot in the private sphere, one foot in the public sphere.
I think
definitely when you're considering like how proper it is for women, I'm not sure if this is subversive or not, but they always talk about in the kind of the establishment of the School of Edinburgh Cookery School that it's about ensuring that women in the home can provide economical meals that has high nutrition. Everything seems very logical, but like you're saying, what it led to was an emancipation in many ways for a lot of women.
I think the health, because you bring up sort of this idea around improving health and that kind of concern about health in the community, a lot of action and support for domestic science colleges accelerated with the Boer War and that realization that there was a lot of people in the country that were not nutritionally well enough to fight, basically. Mm-hmm. And this idea that, I mean, we've spoken about, you know, women being the angel of the home, and that in turn, it was sort of put on women as, it's your responsibility to make sure that the people that live in your household are fit and well, and that they have an adequate dinner on their plate, and we can teach you how to do it if you come to these cookery schools. If you come to our cookery lectures, then we can make sure that you have health, happiness and prosperity in your household.
And it's really interesting, because like I've looked at some of the like the cookbooks before these institutions existed, and it was the same message, but women were completely unsupported in it, and there was so much sort of moral and societal guilt that was like, oh well, you know, if you can't cook this, you know, if you can't cook the cheap, healthy, tasty meal, your husband's going to go out and he's going to get drunk and he's probably going to be an adulterer and your children are going to be really unhappy. But beyond the texts, which were very didactic in a way that was pretty unpleasant, there wasn't a support. So I think the amazing thing about these institutions was it was an actual kind of place that recognized that this was hard work, right? This is not just something that was inbuilt. It was something you needed training in.
Yeah. I think that domestic science to this day, it maintains that kind of historiographical reputation as the Cinderella subject. You know, it's criticized because it didn't really lighten women's domestic labor. It's very much denigrated by certain branches of feminism. But at the same time, you're right, Lindsay, it was an acknowledgement that the role that women performed in the home was multifaceted, and it was backbreaking labor from it was start of the day till the end of the day.
I wonder, so just to cut in, Peter, do you have anything else you want to say about Edinburgh and your women there, or your cookbook? Or
no, I was just googling didactic.
Didactic is when you teach someone something, ironically
enough. Ironically enough. As I was googling didactic, I was like, okay, I'm not going to ask about that. I am finished with Queen Margaret University, the Edinburgh Cookery School.
Of course. I feel like this is a natural point to bring you in, Eleanor, because your research really fascinatingly kind of joins the dots between a lot of the stuff we've been talking about, but in quite an unusual way. And as you'd mentioned, you know, your interest is electrical appliances and equipment. And I wonder if you could just talk about, like, what's going on? What have these schools that we've discussed, these colleges, set up that then goes on to change technology and innovation?
Thank you. I think what I'm going to do is I'm going to get us to go in a time machine and hop forward a little bit to sort of looking at the interwar years. So we have these two colleges that are set up, one in Edinburgh, one in Glasgow. And I should point out there was another school dedicated to domestic science training in Scotland, in Aberdeen, but not discussing that one today. and both Glasgow and Edinburgh, they're providing these, by the interwar years, they're providing these rigorous domestic science teacher training courses for middle class women. That's basically the groove that they've settled into. And they're performing a lot of demonstrations, as I've said, for the benefit of educating members of the community. So they've assumed this mediating role between sort of manufacturers of different, grocery goods, you know, foodstuffs and household goods, and these potential consumers that come along to demonstrations, basically. And you're probably wondering at this point, when is she going to start talking about electrical appliances? So electrical appliance manufacturers, they see the success of these demonstrations performed by Edinburgh and Glasgow College, and they decide that they want to have a relationship with those colleges because they believe that they can best educate the public about using electrical appliances, but also that they'll have they'll be convincing enough. You know, woman to woman in the audience, they'll be able to sell a convincing story about using an electric stove and what that means for the food that you're putting on the table that night.
So when you talk about demonstrations, what were these women kind of traveling around doing? Was it cookery demonstrations? Was it like, you know, I mean, some of my research has looked at Victorian exhibitions, and like you would go and you would show people how to use the new mold of the season. Was it that kind of thing, or was it different?
Yeah, very much so. So to kind of set the scene about electrical appliances coming into the colleges then in the interwar years, there is this anxiety that's expressed by at the time the principal of the Edinburgh College of Domestic Science was a woman named Ethel Delacour, which is a wonderful name.
Fabulous.
And we have Dorothy Melvin, who is described by her peers as small in stature but lion-hearted.
Love that. I would like to be described like that as well.
I know. At the Glasgow College.
Lindsay, I think you need to reprint your business cards because I think you just found your new slogan.
Small in stature but lion-hearted, Dr. Lindsay Middleton. I love it. and they both start to express this anxiety that their appliances and their equipment are not up to date, and domestic science is being left behind. And they're asking these questions of what does it mean for us to be modern, you know? And the electricity industry's marketing after the First World War very much depicts, you know, the enfranchised woman as being master of her mechanical servants. And there is this fear in the press at the time of the servantless middle class woman. You know, she's worried about having to do her own domestic labour. It's a huge concern, you know, and electrical appliances are very much pitched and marketed at those women, you know. Don't worry about the fact that you don't have a servant anymore because you've got a vacuum cleaner now. It's going to be fine. So, and also there's this idea that domestic servants maybe would be more likely to want to work for employers who own these supposedly labour-saving electrical appliances as well. And there's a convergence of domestic science theory with electrical appliance marketing. So domestic science professionals are becoming to be involved in the testing and reviewing of appliances. We have the Good Housekeeping Institute established in Britain in 1924. This is kind of culminates, as you said, Lindsay, in these very sort of aspirational lifestyle exhibitions like the Ideal Home Exhibition, where women visit and they see these very expensive, a lot of the time, you know, out of reach of the majority of the population, electrical appliances being demonstrated by local demonstrators sourced at Edinburgh College of Domestic Science or Glasgow. I'm just going to call it the Glasgow College.
Yeah.
And yeah. And it wasn't particularly straightforward getting electrical appliances into the colleges. There was some obstacles. And this is because there were competing technologies, as you'll be more than aware. Mm. So solid fuel stoves. I believe, Peter, the book that you mentioned, the school cookery book, Christian Guthrie Wright, the instructions about how to clean a solid fuel range, they remain completely unchanged up until 1930, I think, is when we get the first mention of using an electric stove in that school cookery book, which I think what I would understand that to mean is that's a reflection of who that book was aimed at, who the audience of that book was, basically. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Maybe you can answer this for me, because I've got a cookery book that I believe is from the late 1800s. I think it's kind of 1890s. And it was written by a woman called Jenny Wren, who we believe was fictitious. And in it, she talks about using a gas stove and the fact that she doesn't trust it. Mm. She only uses solid, I'm assuming wood fire stoves, because she believes that the gas stoves give it a gas flavouring.
Poisonous effluent. Yes.
why would that be in a cookery book?
Oh, okay, so this is an exciting question. I can't account for who Jenny Wren may have been or may have been pretending to be, but you do get this competition between electrical demonstrators and gas demonstrators in the interwar years, where electricity demonstrators try to trip up gas demonstrators by talking about the poisonous fumes or the noxious fumes that are given off by gas stoves. So I can't say for sure if this is the route that Jenny Wren was going down. Maybe she had a solid fuel agenda that she wanted to put out there, but that could have been it. That's a suggestion.
Is this where the rumor about electrical vapors comes in? Because this is a big thing in the Edwardian era, is about having
Denton Abbey.
Yeah,
the vapors coming from the plugs.
Electrical sockets. I don't know. Is that another gas fueled rumor?
There was a huge amount of public mistrust surrounding electricity when it was first sort of pitched at a domestic market. A lot of that mistrust centered around perceptions of safety in the home. There was a lot of stories in the press about people being electrocuted, even though a far greater number of incidents occurred with gas in the home than electricity.
And I believe the biggest kind of culprits for electrical incidents was actually electrical companies themselves, who were providing wild varieties of wattage or volts that were going into different streets, different homes on the same street. Yeah.
I should say that interwar years, this is all pre-standardisation of voltages, and we don't have an electricity grid. You know, this is very dependent on where you are living in the country. So we're talking about Glasgow and Edinburgh. These are urban areas of Scotland. This is where you have electricity in its earliest kind of infrastructure coming into play. Depending on sort of where your house is situated on the street, that might depend on whether or not you can get a connection to your, and it was very much, it was the local authorities that administered and maintained that electricity infrastructure at that point, because this is as well, this is pre-nationalisation of electricity as well. So from town to town, they're charging different amounts for your electricity as well. But this is one of the ways that they kind of form a relationship with the domestic science colleges, is they can offer them sort of discounts on their electricity, or they can offer them a good price on electric stoves and washing machines if they'll take a chance on them, and they'll introduce them into the colleges and into the classrooms, and that way get women hooked on using electricity, because that's what they were taught to use when they were doing their education at the colleges.
Hooked on the vapors. That's a snappy title. So we like to finish our conversations with 8 questions that we have about food and food history. None of them are complex and they're supposed to be rapid fire. Although if you feel a tangent coming on, please give in to your urges, because we do. If anything, this podcast is for tangents about food. So I'm going to get us kicked off with morning roll order. What is your type of roll and what is your filling?
If I was having a morning roll, it needs to be covered in butter and potentially really good herby vegetarian sausages and ketchup. Ooh.
Wow. Nice. Do you like a soft roll, a hard roll?
Soft roll. Mm. I have a clicking jaw.
Thank you. For sharing. How hard are the rolls that you're eating that it's dislocating your jaw? Like a python on the Serengeti.
Yeah,
someone's going to get in touch and be like, pythons aren't in the Serengeti. Anyway.
Yeah, and you mean Boak and... Oh, no, you don't... Sorry, I was going to fact check you on your snakes, but I think I was about to be wrong.
If anything, this is a podcast for fact checking about snakes.
So, in terms of bread, do you like plain bread or do you prefer pan bread?
Yeah. I suppose... I would probably choose pan bread. If I was out and about and having something fancy to eat, I would have some pan bread, yeah.
Gorge. And how do you have your porridge?
Oh, this is going to upset my in-laws. I don't eat porridge.
That's absolutely fine.
No, fair enough, fair
enough.
Basically
the opposite of the Three Bears and Goldilocks. It wouldn't have been an issue for me because I wouldn't have had any of the porridge. So.
That's, yeah, the version of the fairy tale that Brothers Grimm were not interested in.
Yeah.
Okay, tunics. Do you prefer a log, a wafer, or a tea cake?
Oh, the tea cake, but a wafer as well. I would walk away with both easily.
Well, you're not taking porridge, so we will allow you to have 2 tunics. How's that? And if you were going to add a family recipe into a national cookery book, what would that recipe be?
For the hilarity, my sister, I'll keep her nameless in case she's embarrassed.
No, first name, last name, and postcode. Let's.
Once made a special New Year's Day 3-course dinner for us, and throughout the meal, my oldest sister and I, we became progressively drunk. And by the time dessert came out, you know, my poor middle sister's been cooking all day and she brings out this dessert and it's supposed to be a white chocolate and ginger cheesecake, okay? Mm-hmm. And I think it's like New York baked recipe, okay? Oldest sister and I start digging into it. And in my head, I'm tasting it and I'm thinking, This just tastes like sausages. Just tastes like sausages, basically. And I'm thinking, why does it taste like sausages? And I'm laughing about it. I start giggling about it. And my other sister's laughing too. And we can't help but say, you know, I nearly said her name there. Your cheesecake, it tastes like sausages, you know, and we're dying of laughter about it. And it turns out that my dad had like set fire to something in the kitchen earlier in the day.
Oh, no.
And this had like infiltrated the baked white chocolate and ginger cheesecake, which we now refer to as the sausage cheesecake. So
sausage cheesecake.
For me, it would be the sausage cheesecake that has to enter the recipe book.
Is that like a... like an almost burnt Basque cheesecake, but you just have to create a normal cheesecake and then burn sausages in the oven at the same time. Yeah.
Sausages around it to sort of infiltrate the taste.
So funny.
Yeah.
Okay, do you have a favourite ingredient in the kitchen that you think you reach for the most?
Chili flakes.
Nice. Love that.
That's a good answer.
No hesitation.
No hesitation at all. What is your favourite Scottish word?
Can I have an expression instead?
Please.
Hodgerwisht.
Mm-hmm. Hodgerwisht, wonderful.
That's a good one. That is a good one. And finally, can you remember what the first job you were ever given in the kitchen was? Wafting sausages around cheesecakes.
We've had mashing potatoes and peeling vegetables and all sorts of trifles and stirring.
Washing mushrooms. I remember being equipped with a little mushroom brush.
Heavenly brush, cute.
And washing the mushrooms in the sink for my dad when he was making a mushroom soup that he did not set fire to.
Sorry, is a mushroom brush a thing?
Yep.
There we go. That shows you my level of sophistication.
It's because you're not meant to like get a mushroom wet because it goes slimy, so you brush the dirt off. There we go.
I think
all that happened though as a child was that I just scrubbed the mushrooms within an inch of their lives.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Dr. Eleanor Peters, for joining us today. Where can the people find you? What do you have coming up?
So currently I am an independent researcher and historian, but also I have the pleasure of taking on the role of Vice Convener of Women's History Scotland. And because I've mentioned it, I would like to plug that we are having a conference, a Women's History Scotland conference in Glasgow on Saturday, the 13th of September at Kenning Park Complex. The theme is New Directions in Women's and Gender History in Scotland. I believe registration goes live soon, so please look out for that. And Women's History Scotland is on Blue Sky and Facebook. And we also can be found at womenshistoryscotland.org as well.
Fantastic. I think we'll both be at the Women's History Conference.
Yep.
That's right up our street. Thank you very much, Eleanor, and for everyone else, we will see you next week.
Thank you very much to both of you. It's been lovely.
The Scottish Food History Podcast is hosted by Dr. Lindsay Middleton and Peter Gilchrist. We'd love to give a special thanks to Dr. Eleanor Peters for joining us on this episode. This podcast is produced by Tenement Kitchen.